Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I will be joined by Jeff Ritzman and Greg Bishop, and we're kind of going to go in the direction of talking about why so many researchers in these subjects kind of go off the deep end. It's something both of these guys have looked into, and it, of course, being Where Did the Road Go, goes off in completely different directions. We get into physical evidence and photography and of the paranormal and so on and so forth. It goes, of course, exactly where you would expect with Where Did the Road Go, all over the place. And we're going to do a part two to this. We didn't really get to talk about groups. It's one of the things Greg mentions a lot, that big groups don't tend to stay together. It's something about the phenomena in general. We'll get to that probably next week. But tonight we'll hear from Greg and Jeff. And it's definitely an interesting conversation. If you want to help out the show, become a patron. $3 a month helps us greatly. You'll get a little bit of extra content here and there and some giveaways. And that's about all I have for you right now. So here we go. Greg Bishop, Jeff Ritzman, Where Did the Road Go? So I am here with Jeff Ritzman and Greg Bishop. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Ooh, and you answered at the same time. That was perfect.
We'll try to keep doing that throughout the entire show.
So I wanted to bring you guys in together because you've both had some experience with what this field does to people. And I figure we can kind of go anywhere with this, but it seems like there's two things that happen to researchers of the paranormal, I guess we'll say. One, either they get so stuck in their own paradigms that they're unable to see any way out, or B, they just completely lose their minds. And this also affects the formation of groups and how groups don't seem to be able to stick together very long in this stuff.
Jeff's good at this.
Uh-oh.
I know there's a third one.
Which is?
They react very strongly to what they perceive as BS, and they become like ultra-conservative skeptic.
Okay.
All right. That happens
too. Fair enough.
Yeah.
And it is such a muddied field. I can totally understand the ultra-conservative skeptic after a certain point. When you see all the nonsense that's just spit out there and people take it seriously.
Yeah. Well, it's an ego thing. Cause they're like, won't get fooled again. I'm not going to, fool me twice. And it's like, well, you know what? Have a backbone. If you made a mistake, tell everybody you made a mistake and move on. If people don't like that you made a mistake, then screw them.
And I think with like Bud Hopkins is a great example of someone who seemed to go in fairly open-minded, but once he got kind of stuck in his paradigm, he just kept falling for one thing after another without being able to see any way out of it.
Yeah, that happens a lot too. It just kind of like you'll talk to somebody. It's like, I really respect this person. It's a nice, they seem to be very level headed. And then suddenly they're telling you they believe like a contactee story. And you're like, where did that come from?
Jeff, thoughts? And you're like,
I was looking up John Mack because John Mack is a really good example for me to bring up when it comes to that. There was a woman, and her name escapes me as most people's names do, who more or less made up a story about, an abduction story, that she went in, she let him hypnotize her. And,
the JFK on the alien ship thing.
Yeah, it was that she was sitting on Khrushchev's lap while he was crying, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on and all this. I mean, it was a really outlandish tale, and he basically lapped it up and went to present it to, a big forum somewhere, and she showed up and she said, guess what, I lied about the whole thing, it's all fake, you bought into it. So it's that whole scenario kind of stands the test of the more accomplished or the more people who've attained like a big measure of success, whether it be a business or psychology or the medical field or the scientific field, no matter how high they get up, seems like when they come into this field they conduct themselves in ways that are the polar opposite of what they used to do in their chosen field. In other words, if they did, you know, in their chosen field, what they do in the paranormal, they'd be laughed out of the room. And that seems to be a really common thing. Why, I don't know. I mean, there's a myriad of reasons why, I guess you could put it down to, but it, to me, it's an effect of what the paranormal does to people. This is what happens. Hmm. There's not a why for me. I don't go after whys yet. We don't know enough yet. But yeah, it's that's kind of my benchmark. You know, the more, if they've attained some measure of success or respectability in a non-paranormal related field, academic sciences, whatever, business, they gradually lose all critical thought. And the higher up that they go, in other words, the more accomplished that they are, or the more success they've attained, the harder they will fall, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
In that respect. So the more outlandish stuff they'll believe based on, you know, so like a, I don't know, you know, a guy who attains a lot of a good million or $2 million business will not fall as hard as a professor emeritus of whatever at a esteemed college. You know, that will, he'll fall a lot harder. That just seems to be the pattern.
So I think I know. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go.
I think I may have one of the whys, as you mentioned that, is because when you get to a certain level of accomplishment, you get a lot of fans and yes people around you.
Mm.
Uh-huh. And you don't have the filtering anymore, because the craziest stuff, they're like, yeah, yeah, great, great. You're a smart person. Yep, yep. And your filtering goes away because you don't really, you don't want to really call bullshit something that everybody around you is saying is very interesting. And, oh, there's a siren for you. A Radio Misterioso siren. Everybody around you is telling you that you're a smart person, a great person, and that I think that affects your, that effect, that's got to affect most people's judgment.
True.
I mean, if I think I add money into it even more.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think when you talk about the paranormal fields, I've always been astounded at what a PhD title does for people in the paranormal. I mean, that it's astounding. I mean, it's astounding the way they're treated.
Nothing to do with,
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, even if it has stuff, I mean, I've known Bruce McAbee since I was 23 years old or 24 years old. And, you know, he's a brilliant guy, but I disagree with him on more than a few things when it comes to photo analysis stuff. And, you know, and he I'm sure he knows which cases there are. And some of them weren't even public. I mean, some of them I worked on, but they were never known to the public, I guess, at large. Yeah, there was a great many things that we didn't agree on. And, but here's the thing, for me to go on a public forum and say, completely disagree there, say, well, what are your credentials? Well, I've worked in digital imaging for 30 years. Well, he's a PhD of optical physics. Right. And, you know, so I'm null and void at that point. That's how the paranormal treats you. Now, outside of that field, you don't often get the same dismissive attitude when it comes to that. So people are always willing to listen to different things. Like if it were a crime scene or, you know, some kind of security cam footage that you're looking at for a crime, that's a little bit more there. People are willing to look and listen a little bit more. In this field, it seems like the minute you say, well, I'm outranked, you might as well just go home, because nobody's going to listen to what you have to say past that.
Now Bruce McAbee, he's the one that analyzed the photo of the predator type of thing that was supposedly taken in the woods that didn't really show anything.
That I don't know about. Okay. You know, Bruce worked on, he's worked on damn near everything. He did a really good analysis of the Trent case. He worked on Gulf Breeze to a large degree. Mm. He worked on, I'd say one of the things that was problematic, or would be like one of those things where you say maybe there's a little loss of critical thought, was like the Carp Ontario case, which was, I mean, clearly a fabricated case from the get-go, and involved a lot of questionable personalities, and it was anonymously submitted. And I mean, he went on TV and made some statements that weren't completely, like, it wasn't like he was endorsing it, but he sounded he sounded more positive about it than negative. And and there were a lot of negatives. I mean, you know, when you've got documentation that comes with the footage that you get and you take it to a psychologist and they tell you, well, this person is attempting to portray schizophrenia. that right there should just tell you. And Guardian was the guy who supplied this. This is the moniker this guy went by. I mean, right. It was filled with all matter of crazy. I mean, I knew Bob Exler and I saw firsthand what Guardian sent him. I held it in my hands. You know, it was crazy ramblings and it was a sci-fi story, essentially, with him kind of as the focal point. And it was really easy to dismiss it. But what do you do when you get this footage that you're like, wow, this is unlike anything that we've probably ever seen? And it was. It was amazingly well executed in some respects. But then when you look at all the surrounding, the people involved, I'm going to say it was kind of like an incestuous case. I'll say it that way. people can read about it. If you look up Guardian case, go to Guardian UFO case, Carp, Ontario. You'll see the whole story laid out there. So it was kind of weird because some people were involved that you didn't think were involved, and it was just a big mess. And and it was the reason ultimately that Bob Exler left the field, because basically, in my opinion, got his hand caught in the cookie jar, so to speak. I may be talking out of school here about this because it's been years and years ago, but I remember Canadian MUFON got involved with this at some point, and they were looking for the landing site, and they had combed over this certain area that they thought was where it was. And they had been there, I want to say they had been there like all day or a couple of days, or had been searching for it. And Bob Exler showed up and found it. I think him and his son found it in like half an hour or some ridiculous short amount of time. And again, you can read the report. It's out there online from Canadian MUFON, their statement on it. But I seem to remember something about them saying, hey, Bob, what are you trying to pull here? And he said, what's wrong with trying to make a buck? And, you know, and that was kind of like, I think that was kind of where he lost favor with a lot of people. And and I never really saw him much after that. I'd been to his house many times and thought he was a decent guy. But, I'm telling you, Bob had some footage out of Gulf Breeze that would, curl your hair. Nobody's ever seen it to my knowledge, but it was next level stuff for sure. And this is before the advent of CGI, and this stuff moved like CGI.
Why don't we ever see those things? I saw that. Did you ever see that one outside of Vegas over a mountain? Came out in the, I think it's the early 90s, falling leaf motion with like four or five different lights. That's one of the most impressive things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think they tried to dismiss that as kites, stunt kites.
Nope, because they went behind, there was a mountain in the middle of it, and they went behind the mountain.
Right, exactly.
They'd have to be like 300-foot stunt kites moving at like 500 miles an hour. Exactly. So I don't think, that doesn't work. Doesn't mean there's aliens here or anything. It was just kind of an impressive piece of footage to me.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I completely agree with you. I mean, and one of the things that goes in kind of in tandem along with, the more accomplished people in the field kind of taking falls is that goes almost like a mirror image to the skeptical community who will get that piece of footage like you just mentioned, or will hear a testimony. I mean, one of my favorites is the Kelly Hopkinsville thing, where they decide this is owls.
The owls, right? Yeah.
This is owls.
Yeah.
And these people who've lived in, multi-generational family that's lived in the same place for a lot of years, they've never seen an owl before, even drunk, if they were drunk and they weren't drunk. But, this was what they threw. So it's almost the reverse on the skeptic side, that if they can't explain it, then they'll put out something so ridiculous that it couldn't possibly be a serious answer, and yet they treat it as a serious explanation.
That is a weird one.
It's the exact opposite, and they expect you to believe it because they're, after all, the skeptical authority. And this is the other side of the coin from how fast our guys fall to, in my opinion, that's how fast their guys fall. It's a desperate need to believe and then a desperate need to dismiss on the other side. And both sides make serious critical errors.
Yeah, so, I have actually spoken with, I do know quite a few skeptical type people. And I say, look, you know, I love talking to you, but I hate to say it almost, but UFO people are my people. Warts and all, and they have been for a long time. So even if I think there's something totally insane, I'm going to say, come on, guys. Whereas a skeptic would say, what is wrong with you idiots?
Right.
Yeah. You know, so there's that too. It's this weird kind of, I don't know what it is. I guess it's a group mentality. And I hate to be part of it, but I'd rather be with inquisitive, kind people than you know, nasty, dismissive people. Even if the nasty, dismissive people are right.
Right.
Yeah. It's when it comes down to skeptical people, at least in my experience, you know, I've worked with CFI West on the Meyer case, and they could not have been nicer people. I mean, Derek Bartholomew was a guy that I worked with.
No, I'm not tarring him with the same brush. I'm just using extreme.
Oh, no, examples. No, I know. It's just, but I will say that he's been the only positive person that I've worked with in, as far as the skeptical bend goes.
I've met a few. I mean, they're nice, and they're often quiet if they're nicer. What a strange thing that is, right?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things is, to me, it's like, I had Sharon Hill on the program back when I was on KGRA, and perfectly nice woman on the air. And we had I agreed with a pretty big bulk of what she had to say. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, during the show, she was on Facebook with a couple other of the skeptical bend, and basically it was making me out of a punching bag, essentially.
Really?
You know, tearing apart every question that I asked. You know, I asked point blank, why do you think that some skeptics seem to be unduly dismissive and rather egotistical about it, rather nasty about how they do this kind of thing? And she said she didn't appreciate how I was talking about Joe Nickel and James McGaha and all these people who are, frankly, dismissive and can be nasty. And I said, you know, I said that in the sense that she was not that type of person. She was
right.
She seemed genuinely interested in the topics. And in the end, I call her the most delicate skeptic I've ever met, because pretty much all she did was whine about the questions that I asked her.
I remember you talked about this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have zero use for her. You know, I just there was no point in even talking to her, because as far as I'm concerned, she's the same old skeptic in a different wrapper.
Well, how about a skeptic that you think is useful and generally level-headed who would you consider in that group?
Derek Bartholomew certainly is one of them. I don't necessarily know that I'd put him in a skeptical category, but like Royce Myers, a UFO watchdog, I think is, I think he's a guy that genuinely wants, like, I think Derek genuinely wants, to know what certain things are. And I don't even know that Derek's still involved in the skeptical community. I haven't talked to him in years, but, he didn't know that I was an experiencer when we first started doing work together, and he heard it on a show, and we were already, you know, well into the Meyer stuff, kind of cataloging stuff and cataloging statements and pictures and all of that. And he said, I didn't know that had happened to you. And I said, yeah, well, it's there it is. And he's like, that's really strange to me. And I was like, why? He's like, because you're not that guy. You're just not that guy. It's like, well, I'm sorry to tell you, I'm that guy. You know? We never had a problem. I mean, we never had a terse word for each other ever. He's a real pleasure to work with. I mean, he genuinely wants to get the facts straight and then hold people accountable. And that's what I've always wanted to do with ufology, but of course it never happened. Nobody's ever held to account in this field. That's one of its big linchpins. So
fair enough. I think the problem comes down more than anything to true believers, and whether they're skeptics or believers, it's the people who are absolutely certain they have the answer. You know, the skeptics who go, well, this stuff doesn't exist, so I know, you know, that everything you're showing me is not real. And the believers who just say, well, I know this stuff exists, so I'm more, you know, likely to believe what you're showing me.
There's a big gap, and I think I spoke about this recently on my show. There's a, I think I talked about this with Miles Lewis yesterday. What's the difference between somebody who has actually had some sort of experience and somebody who hasn't, and what kind of gulf that creates in the conversation? Because you can't have the experience on demand.
Right.
It's not really the same for everybody. But if somebody does have a personal experience, this is why I keep pushing Jeff's gospel here in the last few weeks, few months actually, since he's been on. If somebody does have an actual experience of something that they can't explain or is weird or whatever, that changes the way they think about the subject. And if you're lucky, they do it the way that Jeff does or Mike Cleland or a few other people. It's like, something's weird's happening to me. I don't know exactly what it is. I'm going to try and keep some distance from it. That's rare. But most of the time, people fall into two camps, absolutely believing everything, or this is total BS and there's nothing to it. And it has to, you know, there's that dichotomy.
Yeah.
And all the interesting stuff falls in the middle, which is why my magazine was called Excluded Middle. And there's people like that. There's a lot of people like that around now. But yeah, it's like the gulf between left and right politically. It's like the people that have had some experience and people that haven't. It's just the people that haven't. If you're not interested in it, there's no way to explain it to them. There just isn't. So, you know, where does that leave you? It is unique in human experience, or one of the very unique things in human experience that can change somebody so deeply.
Yeah, and I think the other half is that your attitude with it about your own experiences has to evolve over time as well. That's a big thing. I mean, especially with me, like I said to you guys before we went on the air, so to speak, I don't read a lot of books because I got enough in my head that I'm always trying to parse out. And I am one of these weirdos that will go downstairs and sit in my easy chair and leave the TV off and just kind of stare. And I'm going through the files in my head. I'm looking at this and I'm talking about that. And I'm going all this stuff in my head. And thank God I'm a visual person, because if I had to read all that crap in my head, I'd really be in trouble. But it's like, your thoughts about the things that happen to you do evolve over time. It's like, I realize now that some things that I've experienced over the course of my life, especially the more pronounced or shocking things, I see them more as a facade or a theater, if you want to call it that. You know, that's how I kind of parse these things out now. Like I saw this guy in this black outfit, like it seemed completely real to me and even to my dog at the time. But I look at that now and I go, well, nothing evolved for me as I was kind of like led through that. That was not an evolution of experience. That was another facade to another, wrinkle, to another self-negation, to another marginalization of me. That's how, that's how that happens. And that's why it happens, you know, and this has brought me to bigger understandings of what I write about on the blog. And, you know, and I ponder these things for a long time. And it's how you have to make yourself evolve with these. Whereas most people, they have this experience and they just keep repeating it over and over, a la Stanton Friedman, a la Bob Lazar, a la whoever else. It just becomes like, and I was falling into that too. You know, like people, well, come on and talk about your experiences. Okay, great. So there's another time I gotta go on and just say it from memory. And this, I mean, you keep notes on this crap. It's just, this is what happened. And you know? And I love that I'm writing this book with Aaron Parker, and it's like, she says to me, she says, you know, the thing I really love about you is that, you know, I can look back like, you know, 10, 15 years and your story has never changed. I said, what's going to change if it's, you know, if you lived it, it's like, you know, I went to the grocery store and bought a loaf of bread. You know, it's like, yeah, I went to the grocery store and bought a loaf of bread. I mean, I don't get that. But I understand why or how rather that people embellish over time to hold on to attention and all that. I'm sure, and I'm not alone. There's plenty of people out there who just like that's not really what they're looking for. And sooner or later you realize you either care about this and you want to pursue it or you don't. And if you don't, then you leave and you don't really hear from those people. Whereas if you do, you hang around and you start, you know, taking names and then you realize that doesn't work. And that's the evolution of your involvement in the field. So when you realize that, hey, guess what? Photoanalysis really doesn't matter that much after 25 years of doing it. It doesn't matter that much.
Why not? Because it gets you nowhere?
Yeah, because it doesn't mean anything, because it doesn't convince anybody. It's not, you know, it's not ever going to change the world.
Right.
Even if it is anomalous, it doesn't prove what it is.
Well, it doesn't tell you anything. That's the thing. You know, like I think Whitley posted this amazing picture out of somewhere the other day. It was a disc, you know, and I'm like, yeah, it's neat, but it's supposedly taken by an elderly couple. But in the end, what does it tell you? It doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't tell you what's inside it, if anything. It doesn't tell you.
Believers believe, anything. Makes haters hate. That's what
it does. Well, what it does, I mean, to me, pictures like that and pictures like the Crete UFO and all of these other ones, they have these interesting things that you'll only see if you really dig into it and you start doing some math on these things, which are, you know, and some, you know, some hard line, like here's the photo in frame and here's the thing, you know, I mean, like with the Crete UFO, if you look that up online, you'll see it. It's, you know, I mean, the bottom line is that this thing was some distance from the camera of some size. And I stand by that. despite some of the ridiculous, you know, claims made that they think it's like sweat from the goats in the picture and all that kind of stuff, which is nonsense. But you know, in the end, you know, when you look at this picture, it's level in frame, but it's not level to the horizon, which I think says something. I think that says, you want your self-negation, here it is. You know, I'm level with the picture, which means I'm level with the shooter, which means I'm level with the camera. And what does that mean? It's one of those things that you don't see unless you look. But the thing had structure, it had shape, it had symmetry, and yet it was some distance from the camera and level with the camera, but not level with the horizon. And, you know, and those are details that, you know, I've noticed before. But I haven't mentioned them because I'm like, well, is that like, and I called Dick Haynes about that. I called him. I said, Dr. Haynes, have you ever heard of this? Cause I've seen this like four or five times now. What do you think? He's like, yeah, I know. I'm like, you know, he's like, yeah. I'm like, well, what is that? He goes, well, I don't know, but I've seen that before. And that's, you know, that's not a camera trick. That's something else. So there's these little weird things and those things are interesting. What do they tell you? Nothing. The only constant in any of these things, an unknown photograph or one that people can test for decades, is the only thing that's common about them is that they're ambiguous. That's the only thing that's common about anything in this field. Evidence, I don't care what it is. It's all ambiguous. There's no, if there was hard proof, we wouldn't be talking right now. There isn't.
And right.
There isn't, so because it's all ambiguous.
So doing the analysis really doesn't change anything either, except showing what believers already believe and what somebody who is skeptical about it says, well, it's inconclusive anyway. It's just a more refined version of believers believes haters hate.
It is, but if you can get people to examine the edges, you know, I literally examine the edges.
Yeah.
You know, you find some really interesting things, but these are things that most people, your average garden variety ufology guy or girl, doesn't understand what the big deal is. Well, so what? What does that mean? You know, they don't get how unbelievably weird that is. And most people don't. I found a lot of people in ufology, in the UFO public, as I call them, they don't seem to recognize the uber bizarreness of it. They see it in a very science fiction way. They see it in a very right. fictional way.
So what you're saying was, and you know, I sort of understood what you were talking about. What you're saying is, this is a real object in that picture. It has the characteristics of a real object, but it is breaking laws of physics that it shouldn't be, or at least optical physics. Optical physics, but it's breaking laws that it shouldn't be, even though it's a real object. Is that what you're saying?
I don't even know that I call it a law. It's the picture itself, if you look at it, it appears to be a dome with some kind of, you know, darker bottom on it, and it's got an angle. If you zoom into it, it's got an angle that's almost like a 45-degree angle upward on the corner. Now, looking at it, you don't see that it's a symmetrical object because you really can't make out the other side of it. But when you put this thing into Photoshop or any imaging editing program that you like, and you drop it into lab color, which is a really useful palette to play with when you're looking for things that don't readily appear in a mm-hmm. photograph. And you basically have a light and then an A and a B channel. And you can do things in those channels to bring out things that ordinarily wouldn't be able to see, but nonetheless, the data is there.
Right. So when somebody wanted to hoax it, that would not be something they'd be putting in there.
Channel specific stuff is really dangerous to muck around with because it's very hard to make anything look real when you're dealing with channel specific data. So yeah.
Also, there'll be fingerprints of it.
There would be obvious telltale signs. Yeah, absolutely. And so when you look at the channels in that, and you do just a very simple level adjust on like the A or B channel, I can't remember which it was, and then you drop back in to the color palette, you see that, no, in fact, there is another side to this, and it's symmetrical with the other side. It's a whole disc. It's a whole bubbled, sloped disc with the same symmetry on one side as the other side. They match up exactly. Pretty astounding, I mean, to find that. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And so when you look at that that point of it on one side versus the point on the other side, and you draw a horizontal line between them, then extend that out to the edge of the photo, it's level with the photo, but it's not level with the horizon in the environment. And you can't put that down to ocular distortion or anything like that. Because ocular distortion would happen close up and somewhat far away, but not to the degree that this is. It's drastically off. And because the woman was essentially leaning out of a car to take the picture. And you know, it's an odd picture. And and the woman, I know her. She doesn't want to be identified, but she does some really interesting work. And some of that work is reminiscent of what I would see in, you know, like someone who's had experiences of one kind or another. So, you know, but it's an interesting picture. But does it tell us anything past there's weird things that are present here that are weird things? And most people don't. They go, well, what does that mean? I was like, well, I don't know what it means. And people don't like when you say, I don't know. Man, I'm just being straight. That people don't like that. Like they say, what is in the picture? And I said, well, how do I know? Well, you examined the photo. I was like, that didn't tell me anything. Like you want me to say something that I'm not willing to say. And so that's what you got. And, you know, I think for years on ATS, above top secret, I did photo analysis work for them for 10 or 12 years, probably everything that came down the pike. I was in the O'Hare UFO. I was first on that. It's all matter of stuff, and we got some real hoaxy crap. And every time I'd say it's a hoax, here's why, here's the source picture, here's the overlay. I mean, I'd show them. You know, I wouldn't just say it's a hoax and walk away. I'd show them. Right. Well, here's how you get it. Here's how you see it. Do the pieces look similar to you? Do they look like they line up? Everybody go yeah, but a lot of people would like hate you for that. And here I found one that I really couldn't figure out. And they hated me for that too. So I left. Okay, well, I can't win. So, you know, and it's not like I cared about being hated. It's just
No.
It was the stuff that came to you. It was the stuff that came back. It was, you know, well, I think it's goat sweat. And, you know, please stop insulting my intelligence and the intelligence of everybody here. And so that just builds up animosity in your chest and in your head. And you say, yeah, I don't need this, you know, and I'm so much more fulfilled now that I'm out of that. Like, nobody comes to me for that anymore. Thank God. Nobody comes to me anymore. I mean, I'll still do it if I'm asked, but people don't ask anymore. Like, I'm the trickster guy now. So, okay, I'll take that. That's fine. Because I don't have to arrive at conclusions, or, you know, I don't have the History Channel bugging me, and it's great.
I was going to say, you probably weren't on too many TV shows with those kind of analyses.
No, because I'm in, you know, O'Hare, they were ringing my phone off the hook. You know, you need to come on. And I was like, well, okay, what do you want me to say? Like, what am I talking about? Well, the picture. Okay. You willing to say it's alien? No. Who would do that? Yeah, that's what he said. Well, why not? I was like, because I don't know that. Well, would you say it? I mean, would you say it? Like, you could say, you could kind of hint around it, couldn't you? I was like, why? So you could edit it and make me say it? No, yeah. I'm not saying that. You know, I said, if you were having me on this show and put me in that chair and say, you know, try and force me to say alien, I'm never going to say alien. So yeah,
I don't know how many times I've run into that. Well, could you possibly think that it might happen?
Like, that's exactly how they say it, too.
I suppose it could happen, but it's one of many possibilities. Oh, we can't edit that now.
Yeah. And I just said, you know, I said, the bottom line is I can't say anything for certain. All I can say is what I know about it. And what was amazing about the O'Hare pick was that there was a lot of very compelling and interesting things to talk about. You didn't have to make it more sensational by saying the A word. You know, it was already compelling and interesting. It was already very scandalous for the airport and some airlines. Mm. And that was interesting. I mean, that was compelling stuff. And what better place for a UFO sighting, my God, than the most marginal, liminal place as a overcrowded, overpopulated airport. I mean, please, it's textbook.
Now that's the one that left the hole in the clouds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I spoke to a witness. I was the only guy to speak to that witness at length for about 9 hours in total.
Wow.
In the first like 48, 72 hours. I mean, I was up for 3 days straight on that. It was brutal, but neat. I mean, how great was that? I mean, I got to talk to this woman who passed away mysteriously sometime later. And you know, she told me things that I will never forget, about that experience. And she verified essentially she didn't know anything about the photograph that was submitted, but it was taken on a runway, which means it was probably taken by a co-pilot, because it's a very lopsided picture. The horizon is not straight. The object is not straight either, by the way. It's overcast. I found the runway it was taken on, because there's only one runway that looks the way this looks.
Yeah.
And I basically drew a line on a map, on a Google map, and I said, there's the line of sight. So wherever this thing is, it should be, you know, not over gate C-17, I can tell you that. That's a whole nother story. But, you know, when it was seen and photographed, it was not over gate C-17. And I asked the lady who saw this thing. She saw it before she ever got to the airport. And I said, okay, I know where this thing line of sight wise should be. And if she's at this stoplight when she first sees it, it should be up and to her left. And if she tells me that when I call her up, I know I got it. And I called her up and I said, I need you to tell me exactly where you were. She verified she was at an intersection I had identified, and I knew right pinpoint wherever she was. And I said, where was the object in relation to you when you first saw it? She said, up and to the left. And I was like, there we are. not over gate C-17. It may have moved there, but it was not over that gate C-17. I'll say that until I drop over.
Could you talk about her for 9 hours?
Essentially she told me she was going to pick up a pilot who was coming in. She told me everything he had to say when he got on the ground, essentially that they were flying around in a holding pattern because this thing was in the way. They were told to hold. They suspended flights. She told me all about the process of getting to the airport, which was a little bit weird. And then being in the parking lot with all of these people looking at this thing. And she told me it was hard to see. She said, you had to know where you were looking. She said it almost took on a ghost-like appearance at certain points. She said, but what really intrigued me was the skin on it, when the clouds would move away enough that it would get a little darker, which meant the clouds were moving away from in front of it. She said, and this is the way she said it. She said, it just looked like it was surrounded by gnats. And I said, okay. I said, so she said there was the skin of it had this undulating appearance of static. And she said, we were standing there and I saw that. And she said, I burned that into my memory. I knew what that looked like. And I know what that looks like because I've seen beings that look like that.
Right.
They've got that staticky appearance about them. And so I know that look. I'm like, yeah, okay, I got you. And she said, we're all standing there looking at it. And there was a burst of what she said felt like being surrounded by cotton, which is a static charge. I mean, that's a static burst. She said there was this burst that you felt. And she said it made my nose itch. And she said about that time, it went from zero to zip, gone. No acceleration, no wind up, just instant acceleration gone through the clouds, ripped a hole in the clouds the size of the object. And I said, what did the people in the crowd do? And she said, they screamed. Everybody screamed. She said, it was the most surreal thing I ever saw in my life. And I said, wow. And we talked for hours about, tell me, what your experience is with this stuff. Essentially, she had none. And she had never seen a UFO in her life. And, and she said, I was shaking. And she said, when I got to my friend, when he got in the car, he says, weird day at work, And he's like, we're holding. She's like, did you see it? And he says, I didn't see it, but we were above. So it was probably above us or below us. And he later found out it was below him. But alien? I don't know. How am I supposed to know? I mean, certainly if I'll put it to you this way, this is what I kind of wrote up in my report on the whole thing was if it was something we had, it was probably most certainly some kind of malfunction because it shouldn't have been there, of course. I think people called in and asked on Coast to Coast when I was on there about it, said, if it was a UFO, why weren't there, or if it was there at all, why weren't there F-15s scrambled? Why weren't there jets scrambled? This is a post 9/11 airport. What's going on? And my answer to that is, well, if they do, and it's not ours, they got to explain it. Why did you scramble jets if there was nothing there? Because their answer typically is there's nothing there.
Right.
So if you scramble jets and you take a look, guess
you're
what?
You're tacitly acknowledging that there was something.
Now you
got to
say. Now you got to make a statement. Well, we saw something. We don't know what it is. So they, in the end, the airport, the FAA, and everybody else called it a weather anomaly, which UFOs may be a weather anomaly of some kind.
A very specialized weather anomaly.
A very conscious weather phenomenon. nothing's off the table, right? So. Right. That was a fascinating case with everything that you could possibly want, and nobody's talking about it. Nobody talks about it anymore. I'm writing a book on it. slowly. You know, you like I am. I mean, I'm writing everything I know about it, including, you know, that the UFO community didn't really report it correctly either.
Is this separate from the book about your experience?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, I've been writing this since probably since it happened. I've been writing these things down. It's just a matter of like condensing it into something somebody wants to read. But, you know, but I was incredibly lucky on that. Like, you know, I'm not usually the first person people call, but you know, Mark Allen called me up. He's like, dude, we got a hot one. I was like, what is it? He's like, UFO over O'Hare Airport. I'm like, ooh, do tell. And they're off there from there. I didn't sleep for 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
And you know, and there's of course all matter of drama and conflict involved in that as well. So it's not without those hallmarks too. So, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting stuff, but again, it doesn't tell us anything. I mean, it's neat. It's interesting, but that's why I don't do it anymore, because it's not giving anybody any answers. It's only a support structure for something that was reported. You can report something and you have a picture that helps, you know, that's a good picture, you know, something that's decent, which is, it's hard to get good pictures of the phenomena. There's a reason for that too, I think, but you know, it's a good support for whatever you claim to have seen. You know, I see lights in my goddamn hallway, but I got pictures for them. What is that? You know, what does that do for me? Nothing. So, you know, you just move on from that stuff. And that's why I say whoever has an experience, eventually, I think if you care about knowing something or knowing about it, you have to kind of reevaluate and then say, I'm not sure I'm going to buy that anymore, whatever you told yourself about it. And then kind of say, okay, so what about that? And what about this? And, you know.
Yeah. And how they all don't fit together classically.
Yeah. And then what are the commonalities that I know about prior experiences, and how would that fit into this? You know, like, yeah, you got this body of stuff stretching out behind you, all that weird stuff. How does that compare to this weird stuff? It doesn't seem to, because it seems very, you know, very together, very organized and, you know, and productive, dare I say, while most stuff is scary and cryptic and weird and nonsensical. This seemed the exact opposite of that. And in the end I go, well, it's just another facade. It's just another ruse, yeah, to get you looking in one direction while it's doing something else. What's the something else? I don't know. We don't have any business even speculating about that, but you know, we got to collect more. We got to get more stuff. And, you know, and
what would you say about not trying to prove anything to anybody anymore? Because I think that's a dead end.
I mean, I think that's where the blog goes.
Yeah.
I think that's where the blog goes. And
if something is proved, it's just by accident almost. Very individual. You know?
Well, I mean,
how can you...
Even a UFO sighting, an experience in experiential ways is tailored to the individual. So, I mean, we've all heard the story about one guy sees a disc, another one sees a light, another one sees a whatever. I mean, those are not as uncommon as people think. People think that's a rare thing. It's not a rare thing. So, you know, when you say proof to whom, for what reason, for what purpose, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You're working on a thing, and eventually, to come to some sort of conclusion, what is the damn point?
Yeah.
I mean, I got my own point. What are your guys' point for all of even pursuing this? What's the end game? Is there an end game? Do you care? All those things, you know?
Well, for me, I just want to know more. Like, I don't want it to be handed to me. I want to figure this stuff out as much as we possibly can. And I don't know that we ever can quite figure it all out, but I want to make progress somewhere. Like, I want to get something, because I do think that this stuff, like, I think it has something to do with our spiritual health. Mm-hmm. And I feel like like, especially as I get more into this, like when I started this show, I didn't have a problem with hypnosis, for example. And it wasn't until I talked to Paul Kimball and he really, you know, he told me about the whole Emma Woods thing, which I was completely ignorant about. And then he started shooting down hypnosis and kind of knocking out all these myths that I had about it. Because I always thought that it was allowed in courtrooms and stuff like that. And he was like, no. And then, of course, from there, I started looking more into it. And I had you on, Jeff, talking about the whole hypnosis thing, I think a couple of times at this point. Yeah. You know, and I look at this and I think, you know, how many people have had these experiences and that where they should have led to a spiritual awakening, they kind of got hijacked by hypnosis and they've turned it into this horrible abduction scenario rather than what it really was, which they'll never be able to get back on track with. So I want to sort of work on that a little bit.
Do you think that personal progress, I mean, how do you feel about the notion that there may be zero progress made on this subject at large, but for you, there may be personal progress. Is that good enough for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's where I'm at. I don't know about the rest of you, but yeah,
exactly. 100%.
I'm good with, I feel like I've, and I say this, and I know how this sounds, but I'm not a cultist or anything, but it's like, I don't think even George Hansen realized how much George Hansen changed my entire ontological view of the paranormal. Like, he has no idea what he did for me. Like, he literally cut rope from around my wrists. From being chained to so many possibilities and so many options and so many confusing nonsensical things. And also from conflict, I will rarely get into conflict these days because I recognize it now. I see what's going on and it's like counting ducks. It's like, yep, I see where this is going.
Do not engage.
I see. It's not even do not engage for me. It's like, do not even listen. Do not even, you know, don't even pay attention to this. You know, like, this is not even, has right. nothing to do with anything. You know, people say that conflict in the field, which kind of figures into the topic of tonight's show, right? So conflict in the field, I'm finding comes from the way I used to be, which is, you get this sense after you've had it in your life for so long that you kind of can parse things out. All right. So you can kind of like listen to somebody and go, no, I'm not buying that. Or, okay, I like where you're going. And you realize at a certain point that that's really just your taste.
Yes.
has nothing to do with any insight that you have because there, you don't have any insight other than your own insight.
Right.
And so when you listen to somebody else and you go, that doesn't ring true to me. That's meaningless because what may not ring true for you is that person's experience. And you have to realize that the phenomena itself, will pit people against each other. It's, you know, if you just please people, just think of it as a trickster because this is what it does. You know, it will, it doesn't mean that there aren't people who I feel are opportunistic about claiming they're an experiencer or claiming a sighting or whatever. There certainly are those people. There are certainly those people out there who have had experiences that don't mirror my own, that don't mirror anybody else's, but might mirror some other things that ordinarily I would look at and go, nope, sorry. Not for me, I'm sorry. I just don't. Well, you know what? Sooner or later you realize that is that person's tailored experience. I've been saying this experience is tailored for 25 years and yet never in my mind did it click over to go, well, that's their experience and that's their tailored experience. That suit doesn't fit you. It's not for you. It's for them. And so that's how the phenomena kind of almost puts us at odds with each other. Because one man saying, I saw pink elephants, and another one saying, I saw gray aliens. they will fight because I know what's right because I've experienced it, and both have experienced it. Both know what's right, but it's their tailored right. And that's where a lot of conflict comes from. It comes from this phenomena. It doesn't come from us. It comes from our perceptions of things. But it's not our fight. And so eventually you realize, I need to stop fighting this because there is no fight. It's everybody's experiences are their own. That said, I still don't buy into a lot of crap that I hear out there about time travel and Mars and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not buying it, you know? And there's even some people that are, you know, experiencers out there at large that are respected that I go, I'm sorry. I just, there are things that I know that I'm not interested in, you know, I parrot Mr. Dolan from a couple weeks ago in saying, I don't need a war with anybody. It's non-productive to me. I don't care to do that anymore. That used to be, as a guy who did photo analysis, that tends to be where you reside in this conflict. You're in a constant conflict with hoaxers or with believers or with skeptics, or I'm not there anymore. And I feel like I'm a lot more productive with stuff these days than anything else. But everything that I'm at and where I'm at is just the product of where I've been with this stuff. And, you know, and the way that Hansen will explain things to you, you know, it's been a huge value to how I look at this. And it's also guided me into places that I wouldn't normally have been interested to go. And that's where I think, you know, if there's all this big lofty talk by, you know, people like Mike Huntington wants to do like ufological reform, you know, which, by the way, is great if you can make it happen. I don't think it can't happen, you know, and it certainly can't happen while, you know, he tweets, you know, Nazca mummies and Greer and all this other stuff and makes no differentiation between it. That's problematic. So it's like when you talk about ufological reform, that usually means that somewhere in there you've got to include that you're going to have to study things or read books about things or watch programs about things or talk to people that you otherwise would find uninteresting. You know, I'm not into reading books from 1930, but the fact of the matter is,
book, if it's relevant,
you know, a book authored around 1930 called The Enchanted Boundary by Walter Prince. I encourage everybody to read this book because this will talk about exactly what this show is covering. It's the notion of the falls of otherwise critical thinking, sane people into the babble of mad people when they enter this field. That explains that a little bit. It doesn't say why, just points this out as this was recognized way back then. And that was predominantly made about skeptics and the skeptical view of things. But, you know, it's fascinating. It's dry. It's not always the easiest read, but when you read it and you kind of get a handle on that, then that's like, you know, I always feel like I'm climbing up this wall and I've got like another rung that I can grab onto. Like I can grab that. I can go, yep, I see that in practice. Like I see the physicality of that. What's written in this book, I see that out there. That's important. You know, that's how I know I got something. I don't know what it is, but I got something. So it's, you know, it's looking at things that you wouldn't ordinarily think were connected to this and may not be like, it's not a really cool, neato show about ancient aliens. It's not about a sighting. It's not about, you know, it's about here are commonalities that surround these events. And that's where you got to go. I mean,
yeah, I've been whining about going off and reading books that have very little to do with people seeing flying saucers or anything like that. And a lot more to do with, you know, visual system memory, psychology, and also, though it's very difficult for me, information theory, because I think like all these things impinge on the phenomenon and our relationship to it, which is far more important than the object. I think the interaction between us and the phenomenon is far more important than what the phenomenon is, might be, or whatever it is. That's my my in into whatever, figuring out what might be going on. The only thing we can study is ourselves. We obviously can't study phenomenon very well because it's so elusive and doesn't conform to what we think it should conform to. So what are we doing? Why are we affected this way? Let's turn it back inwards and see. And when I start writing, you know, the second or third book down here, that's really what I want to concentrate on here is what are we doing? You know, what is us? What's our part of it? What do we bring to the dance, as I said before? I think that's a really important part of it, that our part of the dance has been routinely ignored, and I think that's a bad thing. We really should look at ourselves. And like Jeff said, it's not sexy, and we're not looking for aliens and all that, but I don't care about that anymore, because to me it's an illusion created by our own culture and wishes and expectations and subconscious processes and even what we want it to be wrapped in with all that.
But the thing is, it's okay. So it's not aliens, but it's something much deeper than that, because it tells us something about us. And really, we don't know that much about what we are. We don't understand what consciousness is. We don't understand what life is, other than the fact that it can end. We don't understand what reality is. You know, it's like these are concepts I think most people don't really think about, but when you really look at it, we don't have answers to these questions. We don't know. I mean, there's so much we don't know. There's very little we can actually prove.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say it's not aliens. Even though I'm anti-ETH, I'm just anti-ETH as a hypnosis of something that we have dangled in front of ourselves.
Right.
It very well could be aliens. I don't know. But I've got this militant model agnosticism. Like I actively refuse to believe in any certain thing. I force myself not to believe in certain things. If I see a belief coming down my road, I turn off it immediately. It's like, oh, whoa, there's a belief coming. Like, get away from me.
Right.
Like this is my experiment for the next, you know, for a few years or the rest of my life or whatever. I'm going to try not to believe that any in a model for whatever this thing is, or whatever any paranormal thing is.
And that's the amazing thing in that about the UFO field is that everyone, like most people who do a presentation of one kind or another on various topics within the UFO sphere, they're giving you an answer. And so when you accept that answer and you hold that to your heart and you go, this is my answer, well, then it's over, right? Yeah. Or it should be over. And yet people go on, even after they've got their answer clutched to their heart. I'm much more content saying I have absolutely no idea what it's about. And I'm not willing to subscribe to anything until I see direct, you know, I see it in action. Like, I want to see it in action.
Yeah.
And I see the trickster theorem in action constantly. I'm constantly saying this, you know, I'm watching TV. I'm seeing these people talking about, having a haunted house. And I'm like, you know, I said, watch, I was sitting there with my wife and I said, and she could care less about most of this stuff. And she says, well, she's my balance. I mean, that's my, you know, she's my pendulum. So that's how I balance out this stuff.
Yeah.
Otherwise it'd consume me, you know? And I'm watching this program and I said, watch, they're remodeling, or they just moved. We just moved into the house. There it is. And we started to remodel the kitchen. There it is. She gets so sick of that. She's like, why don't you turn this off and like go play guitar or something? You know, like, I'd rather you rattle my ears with Slayer than this. But it's like, I mean, you see it everywhere. And so that I can do something with. Do I know why it is? Why is not the productive question? You know, the question is, what else surrounds it? What else comes with it? You know, and the more that you pursue it, the more interesting things you find, such as even tandem things. Think about this for a second. Even tandem subjects in ufology are affected by this same theorem of strange things, irrationalities, all of these things, all the ambiguity. of everything else also spills into those topics because they're somehow tenuously connected in one way or another. In other words, a tandem UFO subject will also be affected by these same strange things, whereas the next step is completely outside of ufology, and it's like completely normal and completely balanced and, you know, and sane. That's fascinating to me. Like, I see that all the time. And I'm telling you, once you see this and once it clicks for you, you never look at it the same way ever again.
You know, Are you scared that model has taken over and that's the only way you see things? Or
No, because I look for it not to be there.
Oh, okay, okay.
I think
you try, to do your own falsification.
Yeah, and I'm constantly asking people, you know, I mean, I just constantly ask people the questions that don't get asked by this field, even the ghost field, you know, like even when I talk to somebody who's seen a ghost. So I say, so what's going on in your life? That's all I say. And well, we just got, you know, Bob got laid off. And so we've been struggling a little bit. Oh, okay. Bing, you know, and it's just, it's every time. And when you get to be able to predict it, you know, that's when it starts to scare you a little bit. Like when you can predict, I mean, the topic of the show is why researchers lose all critical thought. When you can predict who's going to lose it and it happens, you know, it's nothing to feel good about. You know, like somebody's falling, man. You know, like this is not a joke. You know, somebody is falling. And it doesn't end in a good place. It never does. And, you know, and you predict it. Like I predicted it years out for some people. And there it is. I mean, it's right there. So you can't do anything about it. That's the other thing. Like that's something that
script that is run each time.
It's like a repeat program. All ufology is like a repeat program.
Yeah, well, that was pointed out in Angels and Aliens by Keith Thompson in the early 90s.
Yeah, I mean, it's a script. You know, it's theater. Even when I say like the experience itself and the sightings and all that are theater, so is the field. The field is also theater. It's also blood sport in many cases, you know, verbal blood sport.
You know,
there are people who are contrarians in this and they serve a purpose and they are a player on the board. Yep. A skeptic is a player on a board. The new age believer is a player on the board.
Are you a player on the board?
Without a doubt.
Okay.
somebody asked me the other day, so if you're in the field and you're talking about it, and you're studying about it, are you affected by it? I said, yeah, undoubtedly. You know, they said, well, by that notion, are you a trickster? I said, yeah, of course. You know, everybody is, you know, and then you deny that, you lie to yourself, you know, on some level, you know, being an artist, I'm a trickster because I deceive people. That's what I do. You know, and that's not to say I'm a liar or I deceive people about what I know. It means I take the internal and I externalize it, as I wrote about on the blog. You know, the notion of the artist as a trickster is predominant. And so when you talk about a trickster and you talk about an artist, the artist will deceive your eye. That's what I mean by a deceiver. They deceive your eye. They make you see three-dimensional shape where there is none. They make you believe a photo when you shouldn't believe a photo. You know, the digital manipulation that I do every day at work. This is why, by the way, nobody will ever believe a photograph that I ever take. People who know me will say, yeah, of course I believe him because he's never lied about this stuff, and I don't expect him to start now.
Right.
But people, you'll probably say, do you think we don't know what you do? You know, of course, you know, and the bottom line is that, you know, I've been doing what I do for 30 years and I probably, if I wanted to, I could make one that would probably figure out, you know, like I probably could, but that's not something I'm interested in doing either.
Yeah.
Because you either like, you know, I've had events in my life from this stuff that I don't talk about because, you know, it's embarrassing and a little too personal, but this has had a very very detrimental effects on my life. You know, I almost lost my family over this stuff. I almost lost my wife over this stuff. And I don't ever intend to, you know, throw garbage on that by making something up or embellishing one iota, you know?
Right.
Like, not the cost that this has cost me. I'm not going to allow that to happen. So frankly, for me, you know, it's like when I see things that kind of line up, when nothing else seems to line up, that's a direction that I think I should follow. And so far, it's helped me. So that's really all you can expect is for you to get something out of it. And if other people do, fantastic, you know, that's great. But, but we're all players in it. This is all, you know, we're the people most people ignore. You realize that, Greg, right? Like, this is who we are, you know, like, you know, we're not the Richard Dolans, the Linda Howells, and the, you know,
I don't care about that.
Not our role in this to be those people. You know, we would like to be asked to speak more because we got stuff to talk about that people don't talk about that much.
Right.
And of course you and I feel it's important, but the fact of the matter is most people in this field don't think it's that important. They'd rather hear about, you know, alien mummies in Peru and that kind of stuff. Like that's what it is. And the MUFON symposium is a really good example of that. You know, that's an organization falling. That's what that is. You know, MUFON is falling, period. And they may recover from it or they may not. And either way, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because everything is doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing. So people need to stop looking at it as, how terrible is this? It's not. It's everything is according to plan. Just let it happen, man. Just let it happen.
Well, that's a good place to stop this episode.
All right.
I kind of want to continue this with and get into some of the group stuff and why groups fail. But right now, why don't you guys tell people where they can find you, Greg?
They can always find me at RadioMysterioso.com. That's where most of my stuff is. And if you want to go on Amazon, you can look up any of my books, which I would be happy if you would buy. Thank you very much.
Jeff?
Oh, I'm sorry. And I'm at numinousden.blogspot.com. That's the blog that I try to write as frequently as I can on. I'll have a new one up tomorrow, which I think will delight and piss everyone off.
Everybody read that one. I agree.
And by the time people hear this, it would have been last week.
Oh, fantastic. Well, hope you're all still reading.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Like I said, we're going to continue that conversation probably next week with Jeff Ritzman and Greg Bishop and get into, you know, why groups fall apart and see where else this conversation takes us. To take you out tonight, we're going to hear some David Wirsig, and that's W-I-R-S-I-G, off his Teacher's Choice EP. We're going to hear a piece called Dave's Ghost, and this is all available on Bandcamp, pay what you will. So if you like it, go check them out. And of course, any of these artists, if you like them, go like them on Facebook, check out their stuff. It support independent music, the music that deserves it. See you next time.
It begins with a bow, sliding slow across a string, gaining speed. Melody finds me stranded, lost at sea. But the song carries me, leads me to someone who cares. Ought to tell her she was beautiful, but I was just too scared. Oh no, I was quiet instead. Well, all things considered, I'm in way over my head. Take a chance, be naive, 'cause in a week or two I'll leave. And I don't want to regret knowing you was something that I need. We could meet, take it slow, plant a seed and watch it grow. Twice a year we'll find each other in the summer and the snow. That we can be in love anyway we can. And knowing full well nothing happens as we plan. If we run out time to spend. Well, all things considered, it was worth it in the end. So check your shoes at the door. We don't need them where we're going. From the white caps of the Swiss Alps to the Mariana floor. And the sounds from the deep, ancient tongues we couldn't speak, told us love was but a voice that whispers secrets while we sleep. Caught adrift on a wave at sea. If we never go back, it won't matter much to me. I jump off this wooden pier tonight. If you were waiting when I washed ashore, and if you told me everything's alright, well, all things considered, who could ask for something more? If one day I awake to find you gone, my heart would break. I'd probably lock myself inside my room and ponder my mistakes. And the wheels would start to spin, begin the cycle once again. I would tremble uncontrollably, but cherish every memory the same, the same, the same. Well, all things considered, I might be bitter, but it's worth the pain.
Didn't
know. Oh,
Dave's gone.